Mark was a near contemporary. He was actually, he worked with Peter. Peter, who was one of the first followers of Jesus, who was a contemporary with Jesus and moved with Jesus and worked with Jesus and saw him crucified, saw him resurrected, was one of the close friends and supporters of Jesus. And Mark became a co-worker with Peter and worked with Peter in Peter's talking about these things, about what he saw, what he heard. And Mark was a very close, connected person in with Peter, which meant what we have through Mark's writing, which was up on the screen a little while ago, is actually Peter, the eyewitness's record and testimony of what Jesus did and said. It is an extraordinarily close piece of evidence to the person of Jesus, which you can compare to the other actual eyewitness accounts by John and Matthew, both of whom were with Jesus and wrote firsthand the accounts. And so we have actually this incredible mix of evidences that come towards the person of Jesus that you can test, you can check, you can determine whether we have accurate records and they stand up to scrutiny in an extraordinary way. Now, none of that's part of what we're doing tonight, but it is important information to get hold of because we're looking at the Bible. But what we're doing tonight is the beginning of this series, and it's a fascinating series. And we've been asking people about what they think needs to be done to fix the world. And I find this really intriguing. I find it genuinely fascinating to find out what people think. I love to hear why people think what they think, how they've come to those thoughts, where's the connections, how does it all fit together with their other ideas. I do think it's all very fascinating. And so this whole idea of us having talked to the community and hearing their thoughts has been wonderful. But when I hear someone's comments about these particular things, how do we fix the world, fix people, it kind of raises for me a whole bunch of other questions that I want to ask. I want to dig into with someone and find out what is going on. You see, how do you fix the world is a question we've asked, but it has an assumption in it, of course. And that assumption is that the world needs fixing. And we had a very small percentage, 1%, a little bit just over 1%, who said they didn't think the world needed fixing. The vast majority of people, and if you've been anywhere except under a rock, you would have known the last few weeks that our world needs fixing. The terrible things in Martin Place, in Paris, in Nigeria, just hearing reports now of a slaughter there, in North Korea, very things around the world. You would have been hearing all of this and be very aware that the world does need fixing. It is broken. And so we've asked this question, people have answered. They've given us four different answers, and we've taken the top four, I should say. There's been other answers. I've got some very interesting, very different answers than the ones we're looking at. But the top four, this particular one that we're looking at tonight, how would you fix the world? Fix people. Was 25% of the respondents said this was the answer. Now, right there, I'm fascinated again. Someone says to me, I ask, how do you fix the world? They say, fix people. And I'm just intrigued. Like, what do you mean by that? Not in any kind of attacking way, but I'm just genuinely fascinated. Are you saying, so if you're here tonight and you actually answered this, you said, the way I would fix the world is fix people, I'm intrigued. When you said that, as you've thought that, do you mean that you think the problem for the world is people, and if we could only fix people, we'd fix the world? Or do you think it's just one of the big problems and that's the one you thought of? Like, what's going on in your thinking further, deeper and so on? I'd love to get some engagement with that. And when you said, I'd fix people to fix the world, were you including yourself in that answer? What's the problem with the world? How would you fix it? Fix people. Were you going, fix them out there? Or fix us? There's a very famous letter that came into the editors of the Times newspaper in London some decades ago. Now, the editors put out a very prestigious paper. They put out an interest to all the to sort of high-level writers, essayists, and said to them, we want you to actually write for us an essay on what's the problem with the world, what's wrong with the world. And they put this out to very famous people and so on to get the essays and publish the best one. And one of the essays came in, and it is absolutely brilliant. And I've memorized it. This is what I do with my time. I've memorized this essay. So I'm going to actually quote it to you without looking at my notes. And So the question that the Times wanted to talk about was, what's the problem with the world? And the essay they published said this. It said, "Dear editors, I am G.K. Chesterton." That's it. You can see how I memorised it, can't you? It's just a few words. But wouldn't you be dirty if you had been home labouring away on some long essay and the one that gets in is the one that's got two words in it, "I am"? Wasted all that time. But you see what he's just been saying? He's saying, what's the problem with the world? I am. There's a very humble reflection on the problems. It's not just people out there, it's me. So if you're here tonight and you said you think the problem with the world is people, and to fix the world we'd fix people, were you thinking about those kind of rotten ones out there somewhere, or were you including yourself in it? I'm intrigued. I want to know if that's what you were thinking. I'd love to talk to you later. Is it the case that you were including yourself? Now, I don't know. I think generally people weren't. I think the 25% who probably said that generally weren't thinking that they were part of the problem. It's just that people are the problem, those people out there. Now, even if that is the case, I still think it's a very insightful answer, and I think it hits a critical issue. Although it's very pessimistic that you think people are the problem. But is it right? Is it right that if we're going to fix the world, we need to fix people? Well, my intention tonight is to show you what the Bible says, and in particular to show what Jesus has to say about this. My thoughts on this issue aren't as nearly as interesting as Jesus's, and it's actually easy to show you Jesus's thoughts on this, because this question, how would you fix the world, is the question the Bible is actually answering. So this is one of those issues that intersects directly with the Bible. And so you can legitimately and fairly go to the Bible and see what it has to say without twisting and distorting it. The Bible is about this. It's about the reality of the world we live in. It is about the problems we are dealing with. And in fact, the Bible actually starts with the presentation that the world was made unbroken. It then fell into brokenness, and humans were part of that. We were part of that. And then it unpacks over centuries how it is that humans are a problem. But alongside that, it also unpacks wonderfully, it reveals to us that the God who actually exists, not the God of our imaginations, but the God who actually is deeply concerned about the world, grieves over it, and is determined to fix it so that it never breaks again. And so in the Bible, you have these twin themes of the problem, but alongside the revelation and deepening insight into the problem is this revelation of a God who is actually wanting to fix it. And his repair comes to its climax in the person of Jesus 2,000 years ago. So you see with the birth of Jesus, when the New Testament opens, the second half of the Bible, which is what we'll be jumping into in a moment, when you see the New Testament open, you see the birth of Jesus come with great anticipation and joy and expectation. The announcement at his birth is this wonderful thing. I bring you good news of great joy that will be for all the people. Today in the town of David, a Saviour has been born. One who will save. Finally, in fulfillment of all God's determinations and purposes. And so Jesus appears on the scene of history, and he's an historical figure. You can check the reason we talked about the character of these accounts as being a biography, who were the ones who wrote these, is because we're dealing with a figure of history that you can assess and determine whether he's. I spoke to someone this morning, and they said, well, I guess if I'm to explore this, he was wonderfully wanting to actually think about these things. He said, if I'm to explore this, I have to begin just with faith. And I said, no. You just begin with Jesus. You don't have to begin with faith. You actually begin with the person of Jesus. Is he who he says he is? Just look at the evidences. That's where you start. And that will actually feed a conviction about the truth of these things. Well, Jesus begins, and as he begins his ministries, his public presentation of God and so on, he does it in a similar fashion, showing us God's desire to repair and the problem. And he unpacks for us the problem in a very profound way. And I want to show you that tonight. We had it read for us, but if you've got your Bibles, turn up to Mark chapter 7. If not, look on the screen. And if we could slide that first little section up, that'd be great. Thanks. Yep. So Mark chapter 7. the context here, let me warn you, when we look at this part, this isn't easy for us to get. What Jesus is about to say is counterintuitive. It's against establishment popular thinking. It's against the mood of today. It's against what most Christians think even. So just hold on to your seats here, because this is challenging, it's radical, it's profound and provocative. The context here is that Jesus is engaging with the religious leaders of his day. And the religious leaders of his day were all into ceremonial washings to make themselves acceptable with God, presentable with God, clean, not corrupted, polluted, defiled. And they were all into kind of washing their hands and making sure they went through these ceremonial things. But at the same time, Jesus observed that they were very hypocritical. So they're performing all these religious deeds to make themselves clean before God, washing, cleaning and so on. But their actions were perverted and corrupt. And so Jesus comes to the point where our passage begins at number 14 there, which is just breaking up the chapter so you can see where it is and so on. And he calls the crowd to himself and says this. Let's read it. Listen to me. And when Jesus says, listen to me, what he's saying is, take heed to this. This is important. Listen to me. Everyone who... we've not typed that out rightly, have we? Listen to me, everyone, and understand this. There's the end missing. Have you just fixed it? You're going to freak me out if you keep doing this. Just don't make the stage move as well. Nothing outside a person can defile them by going into them. Rather, it is what comes out of a person that defiles them. Jesus says this very simple statement. Nothing outside of a person can defile them by going in. Rather, it's what comes out of a person that defiles them, pollutes them, corrupts them, makes them unacceptable before God, unclean. That's what is being said there. Now, it's a very simple statement. He calls the crowds and he says this to them. It's a very simple statement. Yes, but, go to the next line if you could, next slide. After he left the crowd and entered the house, his disciples asked him about this parable. And now notice how verse 18 starts. Are you so dull, he asks. What's Jesus doing? He's going, the reason his disciples have asked him, hang on, what are you talking about? Is because they're dull. They've not understood the point Jesus has made. Now, we tend in the 21st century to imagine ourselves to be somehow superior to people of the olden days. We're smarter, wiser, cleverer. We can work things out. And so we kind of go, what's wrong with the disciples? How dumb are they? Well, let me show you that actually things are not much different today. And we have the same problem today. And I'm going to do it by this. I'm actually going to get you to consider a question I'm going to put to you. And I want you to talk about it with your neighbour. And I want you to work out what you think. The question is, are people basically good? Are people basically by nature good? What I want you to do is to talk to your neighbour and work out what percentage of the population do you think says people are basically good? 10%, 20%, 30%, 50%? What percentage of the population do you think would say people are basically good by nature? Go for it. Say hello. Do all that. All right, that'll do. Doesn't need to be long. Now, I'm going to get you to do it like this. We're going to get some feedback. I want you to, in a moment, I want you to put your hands up if you think over 20% of the population thinks we're basically good. But I want you to keep your hands up until we're going to work our way up until we find out where we hit. So if you think more than 20% of the population think we're basically good, put your hands up. Just by the way, who doesn't think that? Actually, put your hands down. Who doesn't think up to 20% are basically good? Yeah, no, I don't think there's anyone, is there? Okay. If there is, we'll point you out. okay, back up, 20%. Who thinks 30% still? Keep your hand up. 40%? 50%? Okay, a few dropping. 60%? A few dropping. What am I up to? 70%? 80%? Yeah, okay. 90%? Wow, 95%. This is not about winning. 97%. Okay, there you go. Very good. You win up the back there. I'll give you the stats in America. Now, this is American. We're a rougher, tougher place, and so I dare say our stats aren't quite as high. But in America, 87% of Americans believe that humans are basically by nature good. 87%. And in church, 77% think people are basically good. 77%. And interestingly, if you just look at church, the mainline denominations, not the kind of reformed evangelical churches like us, but the mainline denominations, it goes up over 90% of people who think humans are basically good. Now, what is interesting about that is this. Jesus is saying the exact opposite. Now, I'm gobsmacked. 77% of people who go to church, who name Jesus as their Lord, think he's wrong. And I think it is a tendency amongst us as humans to want to think better of ourselves than we are worth being thought of. And so that I dare say the disciples heard Jesus say this, and they, if we can jump back up to those slides again, the disciples heard Jesus say this, and they go, flip to the next one, and they go, what are you talking about? And Jesus has to explain it. And let me show you what he says. Don't you see? Nothing that enters a person from the outside can make them polluted before God. Next slide. For it doesn't go into the heart, but into their stomach and then out their body. In saying this, Jesus was declaring all foods clean. He went on. What comes out of a person is what defiles them. And we'll leave it here if we could. It is from within, out of a person's heart, that evil thoughts come. Now, the heart that Jesus is talking about is not the organ that pumps blood. It's the centre of their nature, a person's character, nature, being, if you like. And so it's out of their nature evil thoughts come. Sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance and folly. All of these come from inside and make us unclean. They're not foisted on us from outside. We don't commit arrogance, envy. We don't slander because we've been raised badly. We might be aided in our problem with slander because of the way we've been raised, but that's not what makes us a person who is slanderous. The culture and community around us doesn't make us people who are adulterers, lustful, greedy. It might enhance those problems within us. But those problems come from within, says Jesus. They are part of our nature, says Jesus. That's what we are by nature, says Jesus. And so it's an astonishing thing that 70% of people in church think otherwise. They differ with that is to say, we have the opinion of Jesus going one direction and the opinion of churchgoers going the other. I think there's a great danger with nice Christianity, sentimental Christianity, that wants to keep thinking nice thoughts and not actually pursue what Jesus says. It is not from the outside. Bad thoughts come from a busted nature. We are not basically good, twisted by other things to do bad. When we do bad, we do what we are by nature, says Jesus. Society goes through fads and fashions at various times in history. Jesus' insight into humanity has been totally dismissed, and we're in one of those periods of history now. There's a famous psychologist, a man called Maslow, who said this: we just don't have any intrinsic instincts for evil. We just don't have them, he says. So the question was put to him, well, why do people do bad things? And his answer was because of the culture and its perverting influences on us. Now, if you listen to Jesus says, wrong. We do bad things because we've got bad within. We have natural evil instincts that are part of our nature that come out. Now, I'd have to say, though, that Maslow is much more affirming of us. He's much more positive. He'd be a warmer man to hang around, I dare say, too. And if all that matters for you is being positive and affirming, then stick with Maslow. But if what matters for you is the truth, then we need to work out who's right here. Because they are diametrically opposed views on the human nature. And if truth is what matters to you, it's what matters for me, then we need to find out who's right. You know, a period of history called the Enlightenment, about the sort of 17th, 18th century, so a bunch of hundreds of years ago now, made much of this kind of thinking. It kind of fostered and fueled this kind of thinking about humanity. It cast off the notion that we need to have a God tell us how to think and live, and kind of embrace the idea that we are the measure of all things, that we can work out all things ourselves. And in that context, began to think more highly of humans and so on. And it was a kind of a mood that produced certain books where people just wrote them with this whole way of thinking, not even realizing it was actually part of a mood they'd inherited without it being right or wrong. So there was a book called Coral Island. And I'll show you why this matters to tell you in a moment. But Coral Island was written in 1848. And it was a very famous book at the time. And I understand it's not been out of print since. So it's a very popular book. And it was about three young English boys who were shipwrecked on an island in the Pacific. And as they were shipwrecked on this island, left alone, they began to create a wonderful, healthy society. They were confronted by evil, began to overcome it, and they produced order and society and so on in a wonderful way. And it was a beautiful picture of what can happen when young boys have the corrupting influences taken away from them. What is natural comes forth. Now, that was the world of literature, and that expressed something of this whole mood amongst the intellectual people of that era. But then you know what happened? The First World War happened. The war to end all wars, the Great War, where millions of people were slaughtered on the battlefield. And then what followed the war to end all wars was another war, the Second World War, where millions were slaughtered. 6 million Jews were gassed. Listen to some quotes. I'll actually just give you one tonight, a quote from a thinker who experienced some of those events, a man called Langdon Gilkey. He was a teacher in China before the Second World War and got caught up in the events of the Second World War and was interned in a Japanese camp, along with another man, interestingly, a man called Eric Liddell. Some of you know Chariots of Fire, the movie. That's an account of an Olympic gold medalist, Eric Liddell, who was a missionary in China at the time. He was in this same prison of war camp. But Langdon Gilkey was interned in this camp for 2.5 years. And listen to what he said. He's written a book, actually, reproducing his journals of the time that he kept through this period of time. One of the peculiar conceits of modern optimism, a conceit which I had fully shared, is the belief that in time of crisis, the goodness of men comes forward. Nothing indicates so clearly the fixed belief in the innate goodness of humans as does this confidence that when the chips are down and we are revealed for what we really are, we will be all good to each other. Now listen to this last sentence. Nothing could be so totally in error. Nothing could be so totally wrong. There was a man who lived through 2.5 years of seeing people stripped back to bare minimum. He got to see the officers in charge of the camp and the brutality. But he got to see too every prisoner and the way that when they were reduced to their raw humanity, it was brutality, competitiveness, selfishness, greed, malice. Except for one person, he says, Eric Liddell. But all the rest, when they were stripped back, were very far from being wonderfully good people. What do you have with, I could quite give you quote after quote, but when people were confronted with this massive horror of the world wars, they saw the true nature of humans coming out. The nature of humans which was no longer constrained and kept under check by the civilizing effects of society. And what was revealed was the truth of Jesus' diagnosis, that it's from within. The problem is within. The problem is our nature. It's not outside of us. It's in us. Now, we don't need a concentration camp to show us the same thing. You don't need to go through a concentration camp to learn all of this. You just need to have gone to school. Now, I know you're thinking, isn't that the same thing? But here's the deal. School is a place. You get a big enough school, and what you have is a tribalism that you will rarely see vividly elsewhere, where there's tribe versus tribe versus tribe. There's bitchiness, there's crushing of others, there's lies, there's jealousy, there's cheating, there's using, there's abusing. You take that same bunch away in a school camp where they've actually put together for longer with less supervision because the teachers all go off and have their party getting drunk. Isn't that what they do when they go on school things? But you see, you put that away and it's frightening for the weak kids. It's frightening because of the tribalism that happens. There's a mini hierarchy that forms and the teachers are unaware of it and they're out of it. Now, there was a book written in 1958. So you had Coral Island written in 1848. About 100 years later, you get another book written after two world wars. This book was written by a man who devoured Coral Island, loved Coral Island as a kid, read it again and again. But as an adult, having experienced the world wars, he realised the pollution and corruption of this book and wrote another book to critique it called Lord of the Flies. Now, many of you know because you've been made to read it at that horrible concentration camp called school. But Lord of the Flies was written by William Golding to deliberately critique the view of humanity that presented in Coral Island. And what he presented was, and he gave three, there were three chief characters, do you remember, in the book? And they were a deliberate parallel of the three boys who were stranded on a desert island. And there's a direct reference to Coral Island at the end of the book by the naval officer who comes to rescue them. Ah, just like Coral Island, he says. No. What Golding says is that when you get young boys removed from the influences of society, what they descend into is brutality, bestiality, abusiveness, superstition, and horror. And it was just, that's his description of humanity. And it fits exactly with the teaching of Jesus. It is from within. When you take a human out of this corrupting society and put them on a desert island, what they take with them is the very thing that's corrupted this society. Their nature. Do you know, you go and find a village somewhere in deepest, darkest, as if there is a place anymore, some in the Amazon rainforest basin, some primitive village that's never been exposed to civilization. You go there and they'll be so happy. But you spend longer than a couple of days there and you'll begin to see the undercurrents of fear, superstition, hostility, abuse, that is part and parcel of every single community of humans. Because we take this problem that is in our hearts everywhere we go. Now, I don't know how you're feeling right now. It's one of those nights where you go, oh, I'm glad I came along. You know, I came thinking tonight that, I was just going to hear about people and a bit of a problem there and how those people out there need to be fixed and how we might fix them and so on. And what I'm actually hearing is there's a problem with all of humanity. There's a problem in my very nature, and it's me, I'm part of it too. I have this problem in my nature. You know, it can be like you came thinking it's going to be one thing and it becomes this massive, bigger. You know, I was going to go on holidays many years ago, take the family, you know, we were going up the coast and I was loading the car up. And I don't know why I thought this, but it suddenly dawned on me, I better check my driver's license. I just had an inkling that there might be a problem with it being paid up. And so I checked my driver's license. Oh, it's out of date. Strike, I better go and get that fixed up because I don't want to start driving and have a policeman pull me over and say I can't drive anymore and that'll ruin the holiday. And I want to obey the law too. So I went off to the RTA or the RMS as it's called now, and I went in there thinking 10 minutes, I'll just duck in. I've only got 10 minutes on my time. And so I went in to get just pay the thing, get it fixed up, gave them my driver's license, said, look, it's out of date. I'm sorry, I need to pay for it. Can I get that fixed up and what have I got to do? And the person said, okay, took it away and started tapping on their computer, tapping, and said, look, you might need to take a seat. So I took a seat. 20 minutes later, they call me up, 562 up. So I came up. And they said, look, we've got no record of you. We don't know who you are. And I said, what do you mean? And we said, well, your license is not paid for. And I don't know. Give us your car registration number so we can try and track you down that way. All right, well, here's my car registration number. Tap, 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 tap. Sit down. Half an hour later, back up. We've got no record of your car either. Your car's unregistered and has never been registered. We can't see any record of it. What's your address? I gave them my address. We don't actually have that address. Did you live somewhere before this? Yeah, tell me. I gave them that address. Was there somewhere before that? I'd lived in a number of places moving around, trying to escape the law all the time. But anyway, and it turns out, a long time back, I'd lived at a place at Bronte Beach. And when we put that address in, it turns out that was the address on the thing where they'd been sending all the registration papers and all the license registration papers to. And they're all piled up at this person's place at Bronte, which had never come to me. And so I went to think, just, I've got to fix my license. And when I got there, I discovered my car wasn't registered, didn't belong to me. And the next thing they told me was, my wife's unregistered and my kids aren't mine. Do you know, kind of like my whole life has just fell apart. And it can be a bit like that for you tonight. I don't know where you sort of fix the problems, fix the world. Man, actually, you're telling me my whole nature's broken? And every human on the planet's like this? Yes. It is a huge, huge problem. And I tell you, it's universal. Every child born every place on the planet, at every time in history, has exactly the same nature as you. How is that? It's a signpost for us, friends, that there's something bigger going on. Let me take you back to the Bible again. The Bible traces this problem that's universal back to an even deeper problem, a problem we have with God. It actually says that the reason our nature is broken is because of something we've done with God. It says our nature is broken because we've actually pushed God out of the center where he ought to be. Now, to help you see this, I'm actually going to do a visual aid. And I'm so concerned about it making me appear juvenile that I've got someone else to do it. And I got a really big bit of cardboard to make it look more manly. Because I think you're a bit of an ape. But so, Dan, thank you for coming up and doing this for us. And we'll excuse your childish look. Okay, now, just spin it. Show us how it works. Now flip it. now stick it in the bottom one there. Spin it. Okay, that's well done. Thank Dan, that's it. And you can actually put sponsorship on it later if you want something we can use. But now, here's what the illustration's about. When you have God at the centre of your life, it works. That's how we're made to be. Life spins. But when you've pushed him out of centre, it actually breaks your life. And because humanity's done that, it breaks our life and so it doesn't spin. Although, actually, that's not quite accurate, is it? Because it did spin. And if you're a glass half full person, you will say, well, actually spin really well one way. That's pretty good, isn't it? Just like the person who you're sort of worried about a car, your back tyre, if it's flat or not, and you ask someone, can you tell me if the tyre's flat? And they go and look at it and they're really optimistic kind of person. They say, oh, only the bottom part's flat. And you kind of go, thanks very much. But it's, like when that thing span, did you see how it span? It went really fast one part and then it kind of wobbled up slowly and then it got to span down really fast again. I think that's not a bad portrayal of the human nature. When you take God out of center, which is what humanity's done, what you find is that there's an inner gravity to our lives which is towards sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance. There's this inner gravity toward, it's really easy to do. But humans can do good. We can do things that are selfless on occasion and caring and thoughtful. But it's hard. And then it's back down into the other. That's human nature. And so in the last couple of weeks with Lint Cafe, it was interesting that there was a great outpouring after that terrible disaster. There was a great outpouring of "I'll ride with you." Now, people have pointed out the problems with that and so on, but there's something in that was just an expression of human compassion and desire to be together. And for a bit, we did it. But that was 2 weeks ago. Paris, there's been all the kind of gatherings of people saying, we want to identify with these people who have been killed, we want to identify with what they stood for, and there's this great kind of outpouring of compassion and solidarity, kind of up we're going. But in the midst of all of that is all kinds of issues of pride, arrogance, cowardliness. Where were they 6 months ago standing for these things? All kinds of problems that are part of it. And within a week, it's turned into firebombing Muslim places of worship. You know, humans have this brokenness that is so profound. We had fires through Australia on a couple of occasions where massive number of people lose their houses and their property and everything. And there's this great upswelling of interest to actually help. And people gave jackets, jumpers, blankets, all ones that were in the cupboard not being used. But we gave them. We gave money. $100, $200 out of $100,000. We were generous. But within 2 weeks, we'd done it, we'd forgotten, we'd moved on. There is this thing with nature, the human nature. And the problem persists with us. Many imagine that if we can just educate people, give ethics classes better, if we can just give greater sense of concern for others, it'll change us all. We are the best educated people of any time in history. And we are the most broken in experience of life. You know, there's an old joke, which is really rude, but it's so good it's worth saying. What do you get when you educate a thief? A lawyer. You don't stop them being a thief. Now, I mean, I don't believe it. It's a wrong kind of joke and all that kind of stuff, but it's funny. But education doesn't stop. It just gives another way for someone to actually exercise the sinful nature and so on. You know, we've managed to make society work in our country. In Western civilization, our societies work very well. Communism and socialism completely defunct. But you think with me about this is going to stretch a little bit, but the creed of communism and socialism is from each according to their ability, to each according to their need. The great dream of socialism was that there'd be no one in need and no one with too much, a great sharing, a beautiful, harmonious society. But it never worked. And it never worked for one simple reason, because for it to work, people had to be basically good. They had to basically be concerned about other people. Now, our life works, our government, our community, our ideology works, capitalism, which is based on the whole idea of from each as much as I can get to others as little as I must. And it works. I'll tell you why it works, because it trades on the fact that humans are basically selfish. And so it works. Do you see? We have to push to do good. We slide very quickly into bad. And if you want any evidence of this, I'll give you a couple more pieces and then I'm going to move on quickly. A couple more pieces of evidence. There is a Greek mythology about Diogenes' ring. If I've got this is from memory now, Diogenes' ring. It was a little mythology that said there was a ring that could make you invisible. And the idea was that this would display the true character of who you were once you were invisible. And it was a very clever thought. Now, let me pick the men amongst us. Just let your mind go. No one's going to actually know what you think. If you had a ring that could make you invisible, such that you could do whatever you wanted without ever being accountable, what would you do? What would you do? Yeah, whistle. I know exactly what you'd do. And it wouldn't be secret angel. Is that the... You wouldn't be roaming around trying to be secretly kind, because the true nature would come out. Now, I can't work it out for girls what they'd do if they had a ring, because I've asked my daughters and I just can't fathom. But there is a lack of sinfulness that's there in a girl that I just can't work out. I don't know. Perhaps you can help me later. But friends, think about what you do if your first trip away overseas. Completely away now from accountabilities. What are you going to do? I know what you're going to do. Because your nature is the nature Jesus says it is. Now, Jesus is saying all of this because he's got a fix for it, friends. And he's speaking to people who are aware that there's a problem, aware even that there's a God problem, but he's speaking to people who thought they could fix it just by washing themselves, just by a set of laws, by a better government. And Jesus says, no, it's the problem's inside, it's not external. You can't fix the externals to touch the inside. You've got to do something with the heart. And the only way you can fix the heart is a deep, deep solution. Being baptized won't do it. Taking communion won't do it. Going through a religious experience won't do it. What you've got to do is have God himself, in the most heart-moving, mind-blowing, loving way, sacrifice himself on our behalf to pay for our guilt of pushing God off the center and rebuild us from the inside out to change our nature. And so the Lord Jesus in Mark chapter 10, in the same book, says, I didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give my life as a ransom for many. The reason I came, says Jesus, was to give my life to buy you back. And so Jesus gives himself up to death on a cross, so that by his death it might be possible for you and I who have pushed God off center to be forgiven and be cleansed and renewed from the inside, so that we can have this problem fixed in a down payment way. The fullness of the fix is yet to come, and we'll be talking about that in the next couple of weeks. It's extraordinary and wonderful and exciting as we unpack it a little further. But the thing I want to say to you tonight, I'm going to actually pause now for questions. The thing I want to say for you tonight is lift your eyes. See all of these issues, see the state of humanity, and realize that these things are signposts to a far bigger problem that our race of humanity is actually under. A God problem which has created a nature problem which cannot be fixed in any other way, except the extraordinary miracle of the work of the Lord Jesus Christ.